Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt, and today we are executing what we like to call the ultimate knowledge shortcut. We've gone through a huge stack of source material, all centered on the pages of the Wall Street Journal for Thursday, December 4th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Astor. Our mission here is pretty direct. We're providing you, the listener, with a thorough, comprehensive, and just exhaustive report on all the crucial nuggets of insight. We'll synthesize the dense data points and, you know, the hidden implications across policy, global affairs, and corporate strategy, just making sure you are completely well-informed about the currents shaping the world right now.
Absolutely. Let's ground ourselves first, though, with the top-line market numbers. It was a pretty solid day for U.S. markets.
Yeah, it looked pretty good.
The S&P 500 gained 0.3%. The Dow Industrials were up nearly a full percentage point, gaining 0.9%. And the Nasdaq saw a 0.2% bump.
Right.
Looking at fixed income, the 10-year Treasury yield settled at 4.057%. Commodities were a bit mixed, with oil steady at $58.95 and gold holding strong at $4,199.30.
You know, those numbers, they really frame a day where the core narratives are all about rapid reversal.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing regulatory reversals in Washington, a really heartbreaking reversal in global health progress, and even strategic reversals in corporate dominance.
Yeah.
We really have to start with the biggest domestic policy shift of the day.
I agree completely. Let's dive right into that regulatory landscape, specifically the massive rollback of federal fuel economy rules, the CAFE standards. This is not just a tweak. It's a wholesale philosophical pivot by the current administration. It's aiming to fundamentally redefine the relationship between D.C. and, well, Detroit.
That's exactly right. The administration announced these sweeping plans to essentially nullify the corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE, rules that were set to ramp up pretty dramatically. The new federally required average mileage would fall sharply to 34.5 miles per gallon by model year 2031.
And that number, 34.5, it sounds specific, but the context is what really matters here.
It really is. I mean, this is a dramatic drop from the 50.4 miles per gallon standard that the Biden administration had targeted. That's a 16 millipere difference over just the next 6 years. It's huge.
The numbers here definitely tell a story, but the fine print, that shows a really strategic play, doesn't it? This change isn't just about lowering the average mileage. It seems to structurally dismantle the entire system.
It does. You're right. For years, you had this credit system that allowed automakers that missed the mileage targets to just go out and buy credits from competitors.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge financial windfall for companies like Tesla that produced only electric vehicles.
A massive windfall.
By ending that credit system entirely, the administration removes a major financial incentive for legacy automakers to pivot rapidly towards full electrification. And it also does something else. It reclassifies many small SUVs and crossovers, you know, the vehicles American families love, back into the passenger car category rather than light trucks.
And that reclassification, why is that so crucial for the long term? What does that really do?
Because it makes it structurally harder for any future administration to revert to tougher standards. By moving these popular, slightly larger vehicles into the easier-to-meet passenger car standard, the current policy sort of enshrines this change into federal law. A future DC administration couldn't just reinstate fines. They would have to undergo a completely new, very time-consuming rulemaking process to change the definition or the standards again.
So it's basically a regulatory landmine planted for the next 4 years.
That's a great way to put it.
The administration, of course, is framing this entirely as a win for the consumer and the U.S. auto industry. They even dubbed it the Freedom Means Affordable Cars proposal.
And proponents argue this is just a victory of common sense.
Mm.
You had CEOs from Ford and Stellantis who were at the announcement, and they stated that the tough standards forced auto companies into making these really costly investments in electric vehicles that consumers, well, just weren't adopting quickly enough. The administration projects this move will save Americans an estimated $109 billion over the next 5 years.
$109 billion.
They argue it makes high-quality cars easier for working families to afford.
That sounds incredibly compelling, but as always, there is a counter-narrative, and it often uses completely different economic modeling.
Indeed. Environmental groups and climate analysts are warning that this is a short-sighted financial gain at best. They argue that by encouraging gas-guzzling vehicles, the U.S. fuel demand will increase, which could potentially drive up gasoline prices and end up costing drivers hundreds of dollars more annually at the pump.
Right.
And they cite a prior NHTSA estimate that actually projected that raising fuel efficiency standards would save Americans over $23 billion in fuel costs. So you have these two competing sets of economists backed by competing political priorities, offering forecasts that are separated by over $130 billion in impact.
It's just fascinating. And what's also fascinating is that this KFIFI rollback isn't happening in a vacuum. It really seems to be part of a coordinated, very broad deregulatory push.
Oh, it absolutely is. The administration is also seeking to rescind the EPA's 2009 endangerment finding on greenhouse gases, which, you know, is the legal underpinning for many of the rules on power plants and vehicles. Mm. On top of that, they're making plans to open up U.S. coastal waters to increased oil and gas drilling, which reverses prior restrictions. This signals a complete and coordinated effort to prioritize fossil fuels and industrial relief across the entire regulatory infrastructure.
Speaking of regulatory environments, let's talk about something equally fundamental to the financial future of Americans: retirement. If the government is changing how we buy cars, Vanguard seems to be changing how we plan for old age by pushing annuities right into the 401k mainstream.
This is a huge story. I mean, Vanguard is the largest provider of target date funds. They manage something like 40% of that $4.5 trillion market.
Yeah.
So they are taking a major step by planning to let workers buy an annuity within a new 401k target date fund series. And that's going to be available to employers starting in 2026.
And for our listeners, we should probably clarify what exactly an annuity is in this context. It's essentially an insurance contract, right?
It is. It's a mechanism that's designed to convert a portion of an individual's accumulated savings, that lump sum you have in your 401k, into fixed, guaranteed monthly payments for life. It is the most direct attempt to replicate the security and predictability of a traditional pension, which, as we know, covers a rapidly dwindling share of the workforce today.
The mechanics of Vanguard's approach are particularly noteworthy, especially how they're integrating the insurance company TIAA.
Right. So the new series is called Vanguard Target Retirement Lifetime Income Trusts, and it works on what they call a glide path. As investors get near retirement, starting around age 55, their money will gradually shift. A portion of their typically conservative bond holdings will be systematically moved into a TIAA annuity contract. It's called the Secure Income Account. By age 65, the investor will have about 25% of their total 401k savings locked into that guaranteed stream of income.
That paints a really clear picture. So if a 65-year-old had, say, a $1 million portfolio and dedicated that 25% to the annuity, what could they expect?
They could expect to receive around $670 a month, guaranteed for the rest of their life, regardless of what the stock market does next.
And that is the single most important factor for retirees today, isn't it? As 401ks have surpassed pensions, the burden of managing longevity risk, you know, the fear of outliving your money, that has fallen entirely on the individual.
Exactly. Vanguard is trying to solve that problem. Plus, the timing is pretty appealing. Higher interest rates since 2022 have made annuities more attractive because the insurers who issue them are earning more on the conservative bonds they invest the customer's cash in, and that allows them to offer higher payout rates.
And while Vanguard is the biggest player to make this move, they aren't the only ones in the game, are they?
Not at all. We're seeing similar offerings from rivals. BlackRock has LifePath Paycheck, and State Street has IncomeWise, although State Street's version is often a deferred annuity that starts later in life, maybe around age 78. AllianceBernstein even has a variable annuity option that still maintains some stock market exposure.
But adoption is slow.
Very slow. Despite these offerings, only about 4% of 401k plans currently offer any type of annuity component. It's largely because of the complexity and, frankly, the higher cost compared to traditional target date funds. Vanguard's immense market share is the real signal here that this is truly going mainstream.
From securing retirement finances, let's pivot pretty sharply to securing public health, because there is a serious political turf war erupting over the scientific integrity of the FDA's vaccine standards.
This is a remarkable story. I mean, it features nearly all living former FDA commissioners. These are people who served under both Republican and Democratic administrations, co-authoring a highly critical piece in the New England Journal of Medicine. They jointly criticized the current FDA leadership under Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is, of course, a known vaccine skeptic.
And they really didn't mince words, did they? They called the agency's proposed new vaccine standards unscientific and argued they fundamentally undermine public interest. What specifically is the current administration changing that drew such ire from the agency's own alumni?
Well, the core of the criticism is aimed at the vaccine division director, a Dr. Vinay Prasad. He's proposing two major and very costly changes. First, he wants to drastically change the annual flu vaccine framework by requiring larger, more expensive studies on the effects of administering several vaccines at once. Second, he wants to require larger clinical trials before vaccines are approved for broad populations, like children and pregnant women.
And the key shift here is moving away from what was pretty standard practice, which relied on immune response tests, correct?
Exactly. Historically, the FDA could rely on immunological data, basically, showing that the vaccine generated the intended immune response to approve a modified shot, like an annual flu shot. The proposed requirement to conduct these large-scale, long-duration trials for every single modification or combination shot creates a nearly insurmountable financial hurdle.
So if that hurdle is higher, what are the implications for public health and for industry innovation?
The former leaders argue that the sheer expense and the time commitment will delay the distribution of better vaccines during outbreaks, and that this effectively creates a kind of regulatory moat. They say it will become impossible for small biotech companies to bring new innovative products to market, even for established vaccines, because the required studies would just be cost prohibitive. This, they argue, directly hinders our ability to respond to evolving infectious threats.
This sounds less like a scientific disagreement and more like a political hypothesis being imposed on the scientific process.
And that hypothesis is really reinforced by the context that Dr. Prasad himself cited. He recently cited an FDA safety system assessment of 10 children who died after receiving the COVID-19 vaccine. But the crucial detail here is that this safety system collects unverified reports of potential side effects. They're submitted by doctors, patients, or the public. It's designed to flag potential issues for further investigation, not as definitive proof.
Right. It's a signal, not a conclusion.
Exactly. Using unverified raw data contrasts sharply with the official government and WHO analyses, which found that serious side effects from COVID vaccines are extremely rare and that the benefits far outweigh the risks.
And this disagreement is causing obvious, palpable internal turmoil within the FDA.
The signs are everywhere. Prasad himself was pushed out of his role and then rehired just 2 weeks later. There are reports of significant disagreements between him and the current FDA Commissioner Marty Makary, whose own role the administration has discussed scaling back. And perhaps most significantly, Dr. Richard Pazdur, a top drug regulator who ran the cancer division and was a 30-year veteran of the agency, he retired due to disagreements with Makary.
So it's a real brain drain.
It is. And the former commissioners also criticized Makary for moving away from consulting outside expert panels before making major agency decisions, which further suggests a disregard for traditional scientific consensus.
It really raises that fundamental question. Is the goal here to genuinely increase public trust through unprecedented transparency and rigor? Or is it to create friction and gridlock, injecting political skepticism directly into the core of the FDA's regulatory mission?
And it's a tension that we really need to carry forward into our next set of stories as we transition from domestic policy to the complexities of military operations and political infighting.
Let's start with a story that involves highly complex ethics and the application of military law. The deadly Caribbean drug boat strike and the legal defense being prepared by the military command structure.
This is an incredibly challenging situation. You have a senior commander, Admiral Frank Mitch Bradley, who was in charge of Joint Special Operations Command at the time, and he is expected to tell Congress that two survivors of a September 2 U.S. strike on a drug boat were killed in follow-up attacks, but that this action was, in fact, legal.
The justification seems to hinge entirely on their legal status after the initial strike.
Precisely. Bradley's expected testimony is that the two men were killed because they were seen next to packages of narcotics and were therefore deemed to be attempting to continue their drug run. And therefore, they remained legitimate military targets, not protected non-combatants.
But wait a minute. If the men were incapacitated or their vessel was disabled after the initial strike and they were just merely near their cargo, how can the military legally assert they still pose an imminent threat that would require a lethal follow-up strike? Isn't that a massive expansion of the definition of war under international law?
That is exactly the legal debate. The controversy centers on the definition of unable to fight under the laws of war. Legal experts and defense analysts argue that if the men were incapacitated and unable to effectively threaten U.S. personnel or assets, they should have been designated as hors de combat and protected, which means they should have been rescued, not retargeted.
But the administration has a counterargument.
The counterargument from the administration is that the men were believed to be communicating via radio with the broader drug network, and that the damaged vessel and the narcotics themselves remained part of the enemy's operating structure.
And Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who authorized the operation, has strongly backed this second strike, framing the entire campaign as a military conflict, not a law enforcement operation.
Hegseth claimed, quote, "You're going to find that this is war." The administration views drug traffickers as terrorists who are funding deadly actions against the U.S. This is crucial because it gives the military broader authority to use lethal force, rather than the much more restricted rules of engagement for law enforcement. President Trump has also weighed in, signaling support for releasing the surveillance video of the operation to prove the military's case.
The broader context here is just chilling. This strike was the first instance where the administration targeted and killed survivors in follow-up attacks.
And the overall campaign has already launched 21 strikes, resulting in over 80 deaths. Law of war analysts are intensely critical of this overall approach. They argue that using military force against drug traffickers, who, let's be honest, primarily supply narcotics to willing buyers, is a vast overreach and inappropriately conflates criminality with a state-level military threat.
And this legal disagreement seems to be the direct cause of the significant internal discord we're seeing at the top of the military command structure.
It connects directly to the ouster of a four-star commander. Defense Secretary Hegseth asked Admiral Alvin Halsey, who's known as Bull, the head of U.S. military operations in the Caribbean, or Southcom, to step down. And this was a de facto ouster, culminating months of intense tension.
And Halsey had initial concerns about the legality of those lethal strikes on the drug boats, which led to a confrontation where the secretary reportedly told him, "You're either on the team or you're not."
That quote, it just perfectly encapsulates the tension between political loyalty and traditional military procedure. It's extraordinary to oust a four-star commander during an unfolding military campaign. And while Halsey had previously advocated for a more muscular approach to dismantle the drug cartels in his confirmation hearing, the specific legal murkiness surrounding lethal force against seemingly incapacitated survivors appears to have been the breaking point. It really illustrates that some service members are raising serious legal concerns that are just not being easily tolerated by the current political leadership.
Adding to Hegseth's list of controversies is what the Pentagon watchdog has now called Signalgate.
Yeah, the Pentagon watchdog found that the secretary violated some department regulations by using his personal cell phone to share highly sensitive operational details on the encrypted app Signal. These details included the exact timing and specific assets involved in military operations.
I mean, Signal is encrypted, but it's fundamentally an unclassified communication system. What was the risk the watchdog identified?
The report concluded that the shared details would have posed a risk to both troops and the mission if they had been intercepted by foreign intelligence or malicious actors. While Hegseth claimed he intentionally declassified the information, arguing it posed no threat, the report maintained that using an unclassified system for this kind of operational planning was a violation of security protocols. It just continues to highlight this tension between the top political appointee and the established military security procedures.
Moving from military command issues to political infighting, the Republican House conference seems to be fracturing again, specifically between Representative Elise Stefanik and House Speaker Mike Johnson.
And the infighting is highly public and deeply personal. Stefanik, who is a prominent Trump ally and has ambitions for higher office, openly criticized Johnson, calling him an ineffective leader and a political novice who is clearly losing control of the GOP conference as the midterms approach.
That is some high political drama. What were her specific actionable grievances beyond the personal attacks?
Well, she cited several failures that she argues are harming the GOP's electoral chances. Johnson's handling of the government shutdown last month, the weak showings in recent special elections, and his failure to aggressively address rising health care costs. Critically, she made the extraordinary claim that she believed a majority of Republicans would vote for new leadership if a roll call vote were held today, which signals that the dissatisfaction is widespread.
And the catalyst for this public spat was a legislative provision Stefanik wanted in the annual defense policy bill, correct?
Yes. Stefanik was pushing for a provision that would require notification if the FBI probes federal candidates. Johnson attributed the dispute to a simple communication breakdown, trying to downplay the rift. But the reality is the underlying fracture is deep. Stefanik explicitly contrasted Johnson's lack of political savvy with the political animal abilities of former Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
And we saw further evidence of this disunity when Republicans forced a highly symbolic vote, despite Johnson's initial objections.
Exactly. Four Republicans joined with Democrats to force a vote on releasing the Jeffrey Epstein files, which was a clear maneuver to undercut the speaker and force the issue. It indicates that Johnson simply lacks the control necessary to manage his conference. This ongoing disarray is a serious concern for the GOP heading into a tough election cycle.
Before we move overseas, we have to cover the notable presidential pardons that made headlines this week.
We have two really fascinating examples that demonstrate the wide application of presidential pardon power. First, President Trump pardoned Texas Democratic Representative Henry Queller and his wife, Imelda. The Quellers were charged back in May of 2024 with allegedly taking nearly $600,000 in foreign bribes.
And what were the alleged bribes for?
The charges alleged the money came from two foreign sources, an Azerbaijan-controlled energy company and a Mexican bank. The charges suggested the payments were for policy favors and advice that benefited those entities.
The political spin on this pardon is highly strategic, especially given that Queller is a Democrat.
It's purely political. Trump framed this as protecting Queller, who's a moderate Democrat and has been critical of the current administration's border policies, from a weaponized Justice Department. By arguing Queller was punished for criticizing policy, Trump appeals to his base while simultaneously creating goodwill with a powerful border Democrat. And Queller, who remains popular, plans to run for re-election.
The second pardon is perhaps even more interesting, given who brought the charges in the first place.
That would be the pardon of Timothy Leidwick, the former CEO of Oak View Group. He was charged by Trump's own Justice Department appointees for conspiring with a rival to rig the competitive bidding process for building a new arena for the University of Texas in Austin. This really demonstrates that the pardon power is applied broadly, sometimes even overriding the legal work of the president's own appointees. Leidwick, in turn, expressed profound gratitude to the president.
That concludes our look at the domestic battles, both regulatory and political. Let's pivot now to global affairs and geopolitical flashpoints, starting with an absolutely astonishing covert operation in Mexico.
The drama is really high here. Mexico's government turned over more than 55 top cartel leaders. We're talking figures from Sinaloa, Jalisco New Generation, and the Zetas to the U.S. in these high-stakes cloak-and-dagger missions this year. The source described it as a snitch-or-suffer mission, which highlights the pressure that was applied by the U.S.
This sounds far more involved than a standard extradition. It must have required significant operational security.
It required a massive secret undertaking. To avoid leaks, prison riots, or assassination attempts by the cartels, the transfers involved 2,000 Mexican special forces. They had to replace the entire prison staff, they had to switch catering companies to prevent poisoning, and they had to use armored convoys with decoys to move the prisoners, some of whom were highly influential, like the Trevino brothers, who ran a cartel network of 600 inmates from their cell.
And crucially, Mexico achieved this by using national security grounds to expel the prisoners, which bypassed traditional extradition and due process requirements.
And that's the legally dubious part. By invoking national security, Mexican officials effectively short-circuited the legal process, which drew criticism from lawyers and human rights groups. However, the motivation for the Mexican government was pretty clear. They were under intense pressure from the Trump administration, fearing the imposition of punitive tariffs or even unilateral U.S. drone strikes on fentanyl labs if cooperation didn't drastically increase. Their goal was to help the new Sheinbaum administration stabilize relations and avoid U.S. intervention.
So what's the U.S. strategic payoff for receiving these high-value prisoners?
The intelligence value is just invaluable. U.S. officials anticipate that these top figures will share firsthand knowledge about the inner workings of the Mexican underworld, the most current smuggling routes, complex money laundering schemes, and, most critically, the identities of corrupt officials within the Mexican government, military, and financial sectors who are on the cartel's payroll. We already know that Joaquin Guzman Lopez, a son of El Chapo, is cooperating with U.S. authorities, which is a major victory for intelligence gathering.
From North America, let's jump over to Europe and the complex financial dance involving the EU, Russia, and the plan to use frozen assets for Ukraine aid.
The European Union has dramatically scaled back its proposal to use frozen Russian central bank assets to make a massive loan to Ukraine. The proposal is now for about $105 billion over 2 years, and that's down from the originally discussed $186 billion.
Why the reduction? Does the EU suddenly lack confidence in the plan?
The reduction was strategic on multiple fronts. First, it addresses Belgian concerns about financial exposure from potential legal challenges, as most of the $245 billion in sanctioned Russian central bank assets are held by Euroclear, which is based in Brussels. Second, and maybe more importantly, the reduced amount leaves sufficient reserves open to align with a proposed Trump administration plan.
And that plan that uses these assets as a potential negotiation tool for a peace deal.
Exactly. The Trump administration has floated the idea of using $100 billion of those frozen assets as a lure to draw Russia into a peace deal, with the remainder earmarked for future U.S.-Russian economic projects. By scaling back their aid proposal, European capitals are essentially signaling they can allow Kyiv to continue buying weapons without appearing to outright oppose or undermine Trump's peace proposals should they materialize. It's a very pragmatic balancing act.
And related to European dependence on Moscow, the EU achieved a major energy milestone this week.
A historic one, really. The EU reached a deal to permanently halt imports of Russian gas. This signals the definitive end of an energy relationship that defined the continent for decades. The phase-out schedule is clear. All Russian gas imports will be banned from fall 2027, with earlier phase-outs for liquefied natural gas by the end of 2026 and pipeline gas by September 2027.
And this reflects the drastic reduction in dependence that's already been achieved. Russia's share of EU gas imports has fallen from, what, 45% before the invasion to just 13% today.
It's a declaration of energy sovereignty. The EU now officially labels Russia as an unreliable supplier. And this ban formalizes the severing of those energy ties, making it virtually impossible for Russia to use energy as a leverage tool against the bloc in the future.
Next, we cover a truly devastating and frankly heartbreaking reversal in global development. The decline in child mortality is reversing for the first time in generations.
This comes from a projection by the Gates Foundation and the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluation. For the first time in decades, the number of deaths of children under 5 years old is projected to rise in 2025 by over 243,000 more children than in 2024. This undoes one of the single greatest public health achievements achieved globally since 1990.
Where is this rise concentrated, and what is the primary driver behind this devastating forecast?
The majority of the increase is concentrated in African countries that are plagued by conflict, mounting debt interest payments, and severely fragile health systems. We're talking countries like the Democratic Republic of Congo, Somalia, and Uganda. The primary exacerbating factor cited is a 27% decline in global health aid from wealthy donors, including the U.S.
The human cost of this reversal in global health aid is just stark. It shows how quickly decades of progress can unravel.
And Bill Gates called out the specific policy shift contributing to this, labeling the Trump administration's cutting and reorganizing of the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, a gigantic mistake. He projected 5 very tough years, where child death rates may only plateau at best. We see the direct impact in places like Somalia, where the dramatic drop in basic vaccinations has led to severe outbreaks of measles and diarrhea, projecting more than 34,000 additional childhood deaths this year alone. It's a tragic illustration of how policy decisions in Washington have direct, lethal consequences thousands of miles away.
Moving to South America, let's look at Venezuela's economic and political reality. Despite U.S. military and diplomatic pressure against Nicolas Maduro, the real enemy for residents remains domestic economics.
The day-to-day reality on the streets of Caracas is characterized by what we can really call the normalcy paradox. Despite the U.S. Navy presence off the coast and President Trump's rhetoric pushing for regime change, Caracas residents are obsessed with chronic runaway inflation, which is expected to hit 270% this year and surge to an astonishing 682% by the end of 2026.
So, while the drumbeat of foreign intervention feels distant, the immediate financial pain is acutely felt. For example, when you're just trying to buy a Christmas tree.
That's right. People are struggling with frequent power outages and limited water service, yet they're attempting to maintain a sense of routine and celebration. Imported Christmas trees can cost $300, which is more than many people earn in a month. People are more concerned about buying food than U.S. policy. One resident summarized the local cynicism. People just talk and talk and talk and nothing happens regarding U.S. intervention.
Interestingly, Maduro confirmed a recent cordial phone call with Trump, welcoming diplomatic engagement while, of course, denying any plans to step down.
And public opinion reflects the complex circumstances. An Andres Bello Catholic University study found that nearly 8 out of 10 Venezuelans feel a change in government is necessary, which reflects that economic desperation. However, a majority, 55%, explicitly opposed a foreign military intervention, even as 70% had a negative impression of the country's circumstances. They want change, but they want it to be internal.
Our final international flashpoint is a grim one. The official acknowledgement of severely deteriorating conditions for Palestinian security prisoners in Israeli prisons.
This comes from an audit by Israel's Public Defender's Office, which is part of the Justice Ministry, and that lends it substantial weight. The audit reported that conditions for Palestinian security prisoners severely deteriorated after the October 7, 2023 attacks, labeling it one of the most severe detention crises that the state has known.
What were the specific key findings reported by the Public Defender's Office?
The findings were brutal and detailed. They reported extreme starvation, severely restricted access to drinking water, and severe overcrowding, with 9 to 12 prisoners per cell, meaning half of them were forced to sleep on the floor. And compounding this were a lack of basic hygiene supplies like soap and reports of near-daily severe and unprovoked beatings from prison staff.
And this audit comes in a context where the Minister for National Security has publicly boasted about worsening these conditions.
Yes. Itamar Ben-Gvir has repeatedly boasted about his efforts to make conditions harder for Palestinian detainees, including cutting food rations. This audit gives official confirmation to those claims and underscores the human cost. According to a separate report by Physicians for Human Rights, at least 98 Palestinians have died in Israeli custody since October 2023. This is a stark official confirmation of a humanitarian and ethical crisis within the detention system.
That is a powerful set of global dynamics. Let's shift gears now and move into the world of corporate strategy, technology, and financial results. We can begin in the aerospace sector, where the rivalry between Airbus and Boeing appears to be in flux.
For years, Boeing's production issues really made Airbus the clear frontrunner. Now, it seems the fortunes are reversing, at least temporarily. Airbus recently warned of a significant quality issue involving metal panels on their best-selling A320 line, which were supplied by a Spanish manufacturer. This issue will force them to lower their commercial aircraft deliveries for the year to about 790, down from their prior target of 820.
And this quality issue followed a high-profile technology scare that required urgent action.
Correct. Just days before the panel issue, European and American regulators mandated an urgent software fix for thousands of A320 jets globally. This mandate came after a solar radiation event disrupted cockpit systems on a JetBlue Airbus plane, highlighting some unexpected technological vulnerabilities in their current fleet.
Meanwhile, Boeing, which has been plagued by its own production nightmares for years, seems to be on the upswing.
Boeing reported significant progress in fixing its production woes and expects to generate substantially more cash next year as it ramps up production of its highly profitable 787 and 737 MAX jets. They secured clearance back in October to raise 737 production to 42 jets a month, which puts the business on much firmer financial footing for the near term.
But Boeing's major $8.3 billion acquisition of its primary supplier, Spirit AeroSystems, is hitting some antitrust turbulence.
The Federal Trade Commission, the FTC, is stepping in. They're concerned that the acquisition could stifle competition for Airbus. To resolve these antitrust concerns, the FTC is directing Boeing to divest specific Spirit AeroSystems assets, namely those divisions that supply Airbus products and the Subang Malaysian Aerostructures business. This is a clear move to ensure that Boeing doesn't gain an unfair advantage or raise costs for its main competitor by controlling the supplier chain.
Speaking of fierce corporate rivalries, the tech sector is exploring new frontiers, specifically in space, as Sam Altman, the CEO of OpenAI, has been actively exploring ways to compete directly with Elon Musk's SpaceX.
This is a truly futuristic ambition. Altman has been actively putting together funds to either acquire or partner with a rocket company, something like Stokespace, which was founded by former Blue Origin employees. The proposals being discussed over the summer and fall involved securing a controlling stake for OpenAI through billions of dollars in equity investments over time.
Why does an artificial intelligence CEO need a rocket company? I mean, this seems like a massive deviation from software.
Altman has long been fascinated by the concept of orbital data centers. His rationale is purely pragmatic. The demand for computing resources to train and run increasingly powerful AI models is insatiable. He argues that the environmental and power consequences of building massive data centers on Earth will eventually require harnessing the sun's power in space. It's an unproven concept, but major companies like Google and Planet Labs are already collaborating to send prototype satellites with AI chips into orbit by 2027.
However, the source indicates these talks have cooled, which suggests OpenAI is facing some significant market headwinds.
They are definitely feeling the financial pressure. OpenAI has made hundreds of billions of dollars in computing commitments necessary for this build-out, but they have not publicly offered a clear picture of how they're going to finance it. In compounding that pressure, the company declared a code red internally to urgently improve ChatGPT after it began losing substantial market share to Google's Gemini chatbot, delaying other key product rollouts in the process. When AI execution stalls, even space ambitions have to wait.
From futuristic ambition to Main Street retail, let's look at the financial health of the consumer via Macy's and Dollar Tree. It confirms resilience, but with some interesting segmentation across income levels.
Macy's delivered great news, raising its full-year outlook after reporting its highest comparable sales growth in 13 quarters. This is a strong indication that its turnaround plan is finally yielding results, specifically closing underperforming stores, investing in a better shopping experience, and crucially, adding luxury brands like Prada Beauty and Rodic Gun to elevate its appeal.
And their core customer base seems pretty unfazed by broader economic uncertainty.
Macy's specifically noted that its customer base, which is predominantly middle to upper income, has remained resilient and engaged. Despite planning for a more conservative shopper during the holiday season, the numbers are strong, which indicates that discretionary spending among higher earners is holding up well.
Meanwhile, Dollar Tree is seeing strength from a completely different, yet equally resilient, consumer dynamic.
Dollar Tree also raised its profit outlook, noting that strength crosses all income levels. Critically, approximately 60% of their new shoppers were from higher income households, earning over $100,000 annually. This suggests a broad consumer shift toward value, even if they don't strictly need it. However, the growth was also heavily fueled by lower income households depending on them more than ever, with the average spend for lower income households growing more than twice as fast as the average spend for higher income households.
So it reveals that value shopping is a universal trend right now, driven by both necessity and optionality.
That's right.
Let's talk about a new labor challenge facing Amazon, which isn't coming from warehouse workers this time, but from the delivery service providers, or DSPs, the small business owners who run Amazon's logistics network.
This new industry group is called DSPs for Equitable and Fair Treatment, or DEFT, and it went public recently. Their goal is to organize Amazon's roughly 2,400 DSPs to fight for better operating terms and reverse policies they say are just wiping out their profits.
What are their key demands from Amazon?
They're fighting for increased paper package, better reimbursement for van usage, as they often have to keep significantly more spare vans than Amazon budgets for, and crucially, loosening the criteria for bonus payouts that are triggered by the Fantastic Plus scoring system.
That scoring system, Fantastic Plus, that is the key mechanism that determines their profit margin, right? Explain why it's so damaging to these small business owners.
Well, the Fantastic Plus system is an aggregation of many small, often uncontrollable variables. Efficiency metrics, traffic times, customer ratings, even weather-related delays. If the DSP's accumulated score drops below the threshold, the entire weekly bonus payout is wiped out. For a small operation, that bonus is often the sole difference between turning a profit and operating in the red for the week. DSP owners claim this system is arbitrary and penalizes them for factors outside their control, essentially forcing them to operate at massive risk to meet rigid, high standards.
And the strategy they are using to organize themselves, it speaks to the immense fear of retaliation from Amazon.
It does. To shield members from Amazon retribution, the founders are creating a structure of five-person cells, explicitly consulting a military veteran on organization tactics. This is designed to keep members anonymous should one cell be compromised. It highlights the high stakes and the deep sense of precarity felt by these small business owners who are entirely reliant on Amazon for their livelihood.
Finally, in this section, let's wrap up with updates on Salesforce's AI traction and the new leadership structure at Binance.
Salesforce raised its full-year guidance, a win attributed largely to its AI product, Agentforce, which gained significant traction and reached $540 million in annual recurring revenue. Six of the top 10 biggest deals in the quarter were Agentforce transactions, signaling that large enterprises are beginning to adopt the technology.
But despite this promising AI revenue, investors seem a little cautious. Why is that?
Caution remains high because the initial deal sizes for Agentforce transactions are still relatively small, often in the low six figures. Businesses are still experimenting with how exactly to deploy the product for maximum ROI. Consequently, despite consistently beating earnings estimates, Salesforce stock has lost 29% this year as investors wait for evidence of massive, transformative deal flow.
And over in the volatile world of crypto, Binance, the world's largest exchange, named co-founder Yi He as co-chief executive alongside Richard Tang.
Yi, who was described as the crypto world's first sister, will guide the company through its next phase, focusing on its ambitious goal to reach 1 billion users. This leadership change happens just after former CEO Changpeng Zhao, or CZ, who was Yi He's romantic partner, was pardoned by the president. Zhao, who stepped down last year after pleading guilty to anti-money laundering violations, confirmed he is retired, clearly distancing himself from a return to leadership.
Okay, we've synthesized the policy battles and the corporate maneuvers. Now let's move to our final section, covering technology, culture, and social trends. We can start with a fascinating and slightly alarming story about Waymo's self-driving cars, which are learning to be confidently assertive.
This is a perfect metaphor for the shift from theoretical perfection to aggressive optimization. For years, Waymo vehicles were known for their achingly cautious behavior, stopping excessively or waiting too long at crosswalks, often disrupting traffic.
Oh, but the training wheels are clearly off now. The new programming is making them, as the sources put it, confidently assertive. They're bending traffic rules and even showing impatience with pedestrians.
They're moving from following the letter of the law to following the chaotic, unwritten rules of city driving. We have some remarkable anecdotal evidence of this. One startup founder described seeing two white Jaguars, two Waymos zipping and zigzagging simultaneously in a two-lane tunnel, driving more like a taxi driver, an aggressive New York taxi driver. Another pedestrian was taken off guard when a Waymo started accelerating immediately after he cleared the front of the car in a crosswalk.
Waymo's justification for this shift is that being too passive actually made them a disruptive element in dense city traffic, particularly in San Francisco.
That's their central defense. They confirmed the new programming allows for common sense trade-offs, like briefly crossing a double yellow line to go around a stop delivery truck, a necessary human maneuver that old software just wouldn't permit. However, they're also mimicking less helpful human traits, like picking up passengers across the street from the designated address. And we have an official record of the shift, a September incident where a police officer pulled over a Waymo for executing an illegal U-turn in San Bruno. The question is, when the optimization is for efficiency, where does the line between assertiveness and safety fall?
That idea of aggressive optimization connects perfectly to our next topic, where AI is acting as the ultimate shopping assistant for the holidays.
AI chatbots like Amazon's Rufus, Walmart's Sparky, and OpenAI's ChatGPT are now integrated deeply into the retail experience. They can compare thousands of items, analyze features, and even predict price drops. And the scale of this adoption is just staggering. AI traffic to U.S. retail sites rose 770% year over year this November.
So for our learner audience, what are the best practices for using these AI assistants to maximize the shopping experience?
The key is to shift from simple keyword searches to highly conversational and detailed prompts. Think of it as vibe shopping. Instead of just typing living room rug, you use a prompt like, find modern living room rugs similar to this uploaded image made of wool with prices under $500. You can also ask for specific aesthetic suggestions like, I need a light sweater for my trip to Atlanta. It has to be timeless and wearable with jeans and dresses. The more detail you give, the better the recommendation.
And some tools offer specific, really valuable tracking features.
Yes. Amazon's Rufus, for instance, provides 30 and 90-day price tracking, allowing you to time your purchase perfectly. You can also use AI to perform historical analysis on products. For example, asking, why is ASICS Gel Kayano 27 so different from Gel Kayano 30? Can help you figure out if the newer model has features you dislike or if there was a major design change that impacts the fit.
But the technology is still developing and there is a buyer beware element here, especially when it comes to cutting edge trends.
Absolutely. The technology is still imperfect. It can sometimes miss the mark, recommending items that are out of stock. And critically, if you are looking for the absolute latest in fashion trends, be cautious. Consultants noted that sometimes the AI sources information aligned with trends from the previous year, meaning its suggestions might already be slightly out of date and not on the bleeding edge of current style.
Let's move to a major new domestic social policy. The $1,000 Trump accounts for newborns and the ongoing debate about policies designed to boost the fertility rate.
This new program provides $1,000 accounts for newborns between 2025 and 2028. The key structural point is that the money is meant to assist children with economic stability as adults, not for immediate expenses. Generally, these funds are locked away and cannot be accessed until the child turns 18.
We also saw a significant supplementary charitable donation tied to this.
Yes, Michael and Susan Dell agreed to donate $6.25 billion to supplement the government program. This will add an additional $250 per child, age 10 and under, in specific lower-income zip codes, providing a crucial boost to families facing greater economic instability.
The policy is being framed by some conservative supporters as a cultural shift rather than just an economic one.
Supporters, such as conservative podcaster Michael Knowles, argue the program is fundamentally about reestablishing the standard that it's good to have kids, and helps alleviate the financial anxieties felt by younger generations who are struggling to start families.
But most experts remain highly skeptical that this will actually move the needle on the fertility rate, which is at an all-time low in the U.S.
The skepticism is rooted in economics. The policy just doesn't solve the immediate, acute financial hurdles facing young families. We know the median cost of childcare for 5 years is about $44,000 across the U.S. That is the immediate financial pain point. A benefit that cannot be accessed until the child is an adult is unlikely to persuade a struggling young couple facing $44,000 in upfront costs to choose to have another baby today. Immediate accessible assistance is the greater need.
From the future cost of raising children, let's pivot to the present dominance of one man in basketball, Nikola Jokic. The argument being presented is that he is having possibly the most dominant, complete season in basketball history.
The claim is for historical supremacy. The argument is that the three-time NBA MVP is essentially a fusion of multiple Hall of Famers mashed into one player. His statistical output just defies modern conventions of efficiency.
Okay, let's walk through those astonishing comparisons because they are truly mind-boggling.
Okay, start with scoring. He is currently surpassing Kobe Bryant's 2008 MVP scoring average, hitting 29 points per game. Look at efficiency. He's beating Michael Jordan's career-high field goal percentage. Jokic is currently at 62% compared to Jordan's 54%. And look at playmaking. He's averaging more assists than Steve Nash did during his 2006 MVP year, currently at 11.1 assists per game.
And then there is the rare feat achieved only by Wilt Chamberlain nearly 60 years ago.
Yes, Jokic is leading the NBA in rebounds and assists simultaneously. He is truly dominating every aspect of the court. His true shooting percentage, which weighs the relative value of three-pointers and two-pointers for a comprehensive efficiency measure, is an astonishing 72.8%. That surpasses Stephen Curry's record of 66.9% set in 2016, which at the time was considered an unbelievable statistical achievement.
The paradox, as the article points out, is that he appears so unlikely to be this dominant, slow, lumbering, preferring his off-seasons to be spent with horses in Serbia.
Yet, despite not having had a steady all-star teammate in the last 7 years, he has led the Nuggets in points, assists, and rebounds for 9 years running. LeBron James himself said, there's nothing he cannot do on the offensive end, like nothing at all. He is, to the Nuggets, an entire super team wrapped into one incredibly efficient, unlikely package.
Our final item for the day also comes from the world of sports. The ACC football playoff turmoil, which proves that even new formats designed to simplify things can introduce unexpected chaos.
The chaos comes from the expanded 17-team ACC conference structure. The unranked Duke Blue Devils football team, with a mediocre 7-5 season record, has sneaked into the ACC championship game against number 17 Virginia.
How did a 7-5 team jump over higher-ranked rivals?
It was due to complex, obscure tiebreakers. Five teams were tied for second place in the standings. To break the deadlock, the conference had to resort to the fifth tiebreaker rule, the combined win percentage of all conference opponents played. Duke benefited because the teams they played had a slightly better win percentage than those played by higher-ranked rivals like Miami.
And the doomsday scenario looms large if Duke manages to actually win the championship game.
If the 7-5 Duke team wins, the five-loss ACC champion could be considered so inferior that they are ranked lower than the winner of a Group of Five conference. This potentially spells an ACC apocalypse, where the champion of a major power conference is shut out of the new 12-team college football playoff. That outcome is exactly what the new format was explicitly designed to prevent, aiming to assure conference champions an automatic or near-automatic spot. It just shows how quickly new systems can be exposed by the pursuit of optimization and complexity.
That concept optimization leading to unexpected breakdowns is the perfect thread to connect everything we've discussed today, from assertive autonomous vehicles to chaotic football brackets.
It also leads us to our final provocative thought, which highlights the sheer volatility of foundational data, particularly when that data is used to set global policy and financial regulation.
And we're referring here to the major retraction in climate science. A highly cited study on the economic damage from climate change was retracted by the prestigious journal Nature.
This study, published last year, had projected a terrifying future, that the world's economic output would decline by a devastating 62% by the year 2100 under a high carbon emissions scenario. That extreme figure naturally became highly influential in policy and financial modeling.
And what was the singular tiny error that fundamentally altered the science?
Researchers discovered that economic data from one country, Uzbekistan, from a specific short period between 1995 to 1999, has significantly skewed the results. When that flawed data was removed, the resulting economic damage forecast for 2100 dropped dramatically, from 62% down to 23%.
And here's where it gets really interesting. This flawed, highly severe forecast was not confined to academia. It had been integrated into global regulatory frameworks.
Exactly. This study had been used extensively by major financial and regulatory bodies worldwide, including the U.S. Congressional Budget Office, the World Bank, and the Network for Greening the Financial System, which is a coalition of central banks. These groups incorporated the 62% damage forecast into their climate risk tools, which banks use to stress test portfolios to meet increasingly strict regulations.
So the fact that a tiny decades-old data point from Uzbekistan could fundamentally alter global financial risk models is a profound reminder of the implications of data integrity and the need for constant critical scrutiny.
Whether it's informing regulators about setting capital buffer requirements for banks based on a potentially 62% wrong climate risk model, or a self-driving car aggressively bending traffic laws for efficiency gains, the underlying tension is the same. The drive for optimization often requires us to rely on models or data that may fundamentally undermine public safety or public trust when proven flawed.
And that raises an important question for you, the learner, to consider after absorbing all this information. Considering the deep systemic implications of regulatory rollbacks, unverified data at the FDA, and flawed data impacting global financial stability, where is the line between optimizing for efficiency and undermining the public trust that complex systems, whether medical, financial, or automated, rely upon to function?
This deep dive is designed to connect those dots and challenge the foundations upon which these facts rest. Thank you for diving in with us today.
Excellent point. Thank you for guiding us through this exhaustive analysis of today's source material. You are now thoroughly prepared and well-informed.
Always a pleasure. We look forward to synthesizing the next stack of sources for you.
We'll catch you next time for the deep dive.